It's just a week now since the political world was shaken up with the news that a woman was to lead one of Britain's major political parties. Mrs. Margaret Thatcher emerged triumphant from the second ballot for the leadership of the Conservatives after 2 weeks of battling with the then leader, Mr. Heath, and, of course, other prominent elder statesmen. Well, since then, Mrs. Thatcher has had little to say in public, choosing instead to turn her mind to future policies and picking her shadow cabinet, which indeed she announced last night. However, today she's with me in the studio preparing to talk about the victory and indeed about the future that we can expect from the new style Conservative Party. First of all, nice to have you back again, Margaret.
It's very nice to be back. I thoroughly enjoy these programmes and look forward to being on them frequently.
Good. Now, as I said, it's a week since you were elected leader, and obviously a lot of thoughts must have passed through your head in that time. Looking back, I mean, what is your reaction to it all?
Well, it's very strange. It seems as if I've been there for several months, judging by the amount that one's had to crush in the time. I don't think one's still come to the surface because there has been so much to do that one hasn't really realised that the leader of the opposition is me. I think it's only me still. I haven't yet made any really big speeches. Obviously, there have been all the administrative things to do, reforming the shadow cabinet. And as you know, the mass media make very heavy demands on one's time. They trot along and say, what are you doing today? And you say, well, I'm receiving pressmen and doing radio programmes. And that does take up a great deal of time.
Quite. Are you at all sad that it happened in the way that it happened? And do you think that it's damaged the image of the party at all?
I don't think it's damaged the image of the party. I was very sorry for Mr. Heath. Obviously one would be for a person you've worked with for quite a time. And it would, in a way, have been better if, instead of contesting him in that way, we perhaps had several people running in the first ballot.
Yes. Now, we've seen something now of the shape of the party with your announcement last night of the Shadow Cabinet. As one newspaper described it this morning, the night of the long hatpin, I believe, was one headline. This
morning. Oh, my goodness, I hadn't seen that.
Have you seen that one? Oh, yes, the night of the long hatpin. Two main points would seem to arise out of it. The return of Mr. Maldon. Now, not all the comment has been favourable about that move, and I would say it was probably unexpected.
I don't know whether it was unexpected or not. It was said that I was short on foreign affairs experience. Now, in a way, that's quite right. By the time you've had the same person doing foreign affairs for nearly 10 years, obviously other people haven't had the experience of handling it. And either Alec Douglas-Hume or Ted handled it for nearly 10 years. Now, I then looked round to see how could I strengthen that side. Now, Reggie Maudling's probably had more experience of different aspects of government than any other politician living on the Conservative benches. He's done a certain amount of foreign affairs. Of course, when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer, he had contacts with many foreign countries when he was Board of Trade. And it seemed to me quite absurd to have that great reservoir of experience there and not to use it. So I said, Reggie, will you join us again? He said, I'd love to, my dear.
Yes. I bet he was delighted.
He was delighted, yeah. And so are we.
I mentioned two main points. The other one, of course, being the appointment of Sir Keith Joseph.
Yes.
And again, quoting newspapers, which you may well not have had time to see this morning. But so he has been referred to as the power behind the throne. I mean, I don't know whether you would agree with that.
No, I wouldn't agree with that at all. Keith is always a power because he has a tremendous brain and great intellectual capacity. He's a very shy person. He's one of the most sympathetic people. You know, shy people often are very sympathetic, but are rather afraid of showing it. But he had a most marvellous record when he was Secretary of State for the Social Services, and I think he's got a great deal to offer. You always need a first-class mind to coordinate the thinking out of new policies. After all, we had Rab Butler, you know, from 1945 to 50. Keith, in a way, is the new Rab Butler of the 1970s to 80s.
Yes. What about the people, I mean, I spoke to Peter Walker on the programme yesterday, for instance. What about the people who aren't going to play a part in the shadow cabinet, like Geoffrey Rippon and Peter Walker and Robert Carr?
Well, after all, you need a lot of talent on your back benches in Parliament, too. It's not always those who are just on the front benches. And I think that it adds greatly to the back benches to have people on them who've had some experience of what it's like to be in office. After all, when you accept office, and I remember doing it from Harold Macmillan, myself in 1961 as a parliamentary secretary, I thought then the time's going to come when I'm going to be out. And I'm very well aware that the time will come when I'm out. And I'm determined then to make it easy for the chap or girl who tells me I'm out. But if you accept the system that puts you in, You must accept that same system which puts you out and gives a chance to someone else. Peter will be a great asset on backbenchers, and so will Geoffrey Rippon and some of the others.
You would be hoping then, would you, to build a team in depth, so to speak? Would you?
Oh, yes. That team has been built on merit. This is one of my great beliefs. If people have got what it takes, they should have a chance.
Could I ask you, I beg your pardon, just before I play some music, because we're here for a long time, have people's attitudes changed toward you at all in the past week?
Oh, enormously. And I'm told I've changed. I mean, even my husband says you've got a new confidence, or he said that I have changed over the last 6 months or so. I haven't noticed it. But the great change really occurred about a fortnight before the ballot, because all the press was regarding me merely as a means of flushing out the next leader, not of the possibility of being the next leader. And I sometimes had to say to them, look, I'm nudging 50. I'm no chicken. That's about the time when you would expect a person who could be a leader to take over. And after that, they did begin to take me a little bit more seriously. And now they have all of a sudden changed attitudes and realised that they must look at you for your own potential as a person and not as a woman leader.
Are there... Yes, we'll get on to the woman angle a little later on, if you may. Are there any people who are perhaps nicer to you in the past week than they were prior to that?
They were always very nice and very courteous and very kind. There's been no fawning for position at all, and none was promised before I took over. I'm not that kind of person, and the people who are supporting me were not that kind of person either.
Margaret, looking back, I was talking about the leadership battle just now. Would you? What about all the ballyhoo and the publicity that went with it? I mean, the William Whitelaw kiss, and he was doing the washing up, and you were doing the washing up, and so on. I mean, was all that really necessary, do you think?
I don't know if it was necessary or not. The difficulty is, if I might put it this way, to avoid the press on these occasions. They seek photographs, they seek interviews the whole time. And I remember all that session of housekeeping came one Saturday and Sunday when I had 14 of them on my doorstep and in the house saying, what are you doing today? And we had to try to find a different picture for each. As far as the Willie Whitelaw peck on the cheek for us both was concerned, I've never known one peck get quite as much publicity.
Got a lot of coverage, didn't it?
Great deal of coverage.
Had you ever thought what you would have done if you'd failed in the second ballot? Had it ever occurred to you that you might fail in the second ballot?
Oh, yes. I was prepared to take whatever came. I certainly wasn't counting on winning. I would just have carried on. After all, even if I were on the back benches only, had I lost all front bench position, I would still have carried on fighting for the cause in which I believe.
Yes. Could I ask you, what would you miss most about the Ted Heath era, if anything, that is?
Well, the extraordinary thing is it is different being leader of the opposition. All the decisions ultimately come to you, all the tricky decisions, and the really difficult thing of man management, and I say that as a woman. It's, you know, I'm coming to the conclusion it's easier to manage ladies than it is to manage men. Prima donna is a feminine word. It's a great mistake. It should be a masculine one.
You had a week now sort of to marshal your troops and your thoughts, so to speak. What will be the main difference between your policies and Ted Heath's conservatism?
Well, I hope we shall have a clear conservative message. I don't believe that you ever win just by being against someone else. You've got to have a clear message and a banner to which people will rally. I think the difficulty was that in the past that message got obscured and people felt that we were becoming just a pale version of the Socialist Party. That won't do. Socialism's gone too far now, in my view. I recognise we're not doing a party political. In my view, for there to be no clear alternative.
Yes. It did seem, as an outsider, that with both parties going for so the middle ground, so to say, that it was very difficult to tell one from t'other, really, in the end.
It was getting very difficult, and I was very interested to see a letter to one of the papers saying that those who walk down the middle of the road tend to get knocked over.
I like it.
Rather good.
I like it. Does that, though, by definition, mean that you are going to have to move the party somewhere?
Yes, and I'm glad you haven't used any of the traditional labels. I am going to have to make it quite clear that Britain is a place where those who have ability can use that ability, and if they're successful, they can stay here. So many of our successful people then tend to go overseas. We want to build a country for successful people here, and we use their success to help others. I firmly believe that those who work harder or who have greater ability should get greater rewards and keep them, and that as they prosper themselves, so they should prosper others. If you're prepared to save, I think you should get some benefit from that. I firmly believe in law and order and in standing up for authority. Otherwise, we should have no free society.
Hmm. How do you actually set about forming new policies? I mean, okay, do you pick a person for the job and then leave them to do it, or do you give them a very tight brief on which to work?
Well, we all know that we believe the same things, the same general principles. Then they get on with forming their own policy groups under the guidance of Keith Joseph, and then we'll discuss the papers that come in as a result of it, discuss it with backbenchers and also with the party. But on the whole, the head of a department has his delegated responsibility.
Yes. I mean, I've got a headline in front of me here, which you may well not have seen. It's from an evening paper, in fact, which says, "Now Cool Maggie Plans New Purge."
Yes, isn't it a horrid headline?
It is.
I looked at it and I thought it bore no relation to the article underneath. Look, the difficulty is, if you're to give new people a chance, then some people have to go out. I don't call it a purge at all. There are a few new opportunities. Some people, again, will return to the back benches.
Yes. Nonetheless, I mean, hard decisions have to be made, don't they? And although you're not a Prime Minister yet, it's true to say, they do say that the Prime Minister needs to be a good butcher. I mean, would you say that you're a good butcher?
I don't know whether I'm a good one. I'm a reluctant one, but I recognise that this is one of the tests of leadership. I had a horrid day yesterday having to tell people whom I could see the disappointment written in their faces. But nevertheless, I had to do it. I wouldn't be fit to be a leader otherwise. But each and every one of them had a reason, and they were all big enough to understand that reason and to accept it generously, although they were disappointed.
And do you think it's as easy for a woman to take that kind of action as for a man? Or easier, perhaps?
I think it depends upon the kind of person you are, and not really whether you're a man or a woman. I'm sure that Harold Macmillan felt every bit as much difficulty as I did when he had to change people.
Yes. Can I ask you, what is a Thatcher man or woman? I mean, what do you look for in a potential minister when you're picking a shadow cabinet, or one day a cabinet may have?
Well, a number of things. First, you look for creative ideas. Secondly, you must have a person who is prepared to work jolly hard. The hours are long, and there are times when you have to be prepared to drop other things and come along to the House of Commons if there's a sudden statement or a sudden question which you must attend to. Thirdly, they have to be capable of being a member of a team. In this world, you can't do anything alone. You've got to combine with others. And fourthly, today, they've got to learn to be a communicator. That's a new thing.
Yes. Yes, I mean, that brings the whole Ted Heath thing back up again, doesn't it? I mean, how important do you think that, radio as you're doing at the moment, and television as you do as well, how important is communication in that way?
Well, it is very important, but being a good communicator is not a substitute for being a good policymaker. You've got to have both things. Mm. You've got to have a chap who is capable of making policies, but then it's no good having the right policies unless you can present them. Because it's like having a good product. It's no earthly good making the most marvellous thing unless you advertise it and people know about it and want it and like it. It's just the same in politics. But it's no earthly good having a chap who's a good actor and can't create the policies. You've got to have both.
Margaret, the fact that you're a woman has played a big part in the election, in the coverage of the election, let's put it that way. Do you think things would have gone differently at all had you been a man?
I think that's difficult to say. In a curious way, I think in the first ballot, it was not an advantage. In the second ballot, it might have been an advantage because people said, look, if we're going to have something different, let's have someone who's really different. And if it's a woman, it must be obviously different. And you often find that as a woman in a job. It's a disadvantage at first, but once you've got the job, it can be a tremendous advantage.
Yes. I mean, do you have to be at all careful of the way in which you, I was going to say, play the fact that you're a woman? I don't quite, that's not quite the phrase that I want, but you have to be careful not to overplay it, presumably.
Yes, people expect you to behave in a certain way. If, for example, you refuse to go on and do a programme for very good reasons, they say, well, was it for emotional reasons? Men are very limited in their views about women, Jimmy. Very limited indeed.
You're not being very kind to us today, are you? What about taking women onto your team, for instance?
Well, I've taken on Sally. Again, she's been a jolly hard worker and has done a wonderful job on Prices.
She was very good on this programme, if I may say so.
I'm sure she was. Yeah. She's a very hard worker and she's done well, so she comes on. Jimmy, we're not getting nearly enough women into Parliament. They're not coming forward and standing as candidates nearly enough. If we had more, those of us who are there wouldn't be as conspicuous, and it would help.
Yes. What about the women in the country? I mean, one's got to face the fact that the Conservative Party has taken, I suppose people would say, a great gamble. You know, I mean, they don't really know, do they, how women will react to a woman leader?
Well, I know because of the masses of letters I've had. Mm. There are 4,000 or 5,000 now, and they've come from women in all walks of life, and they're delighted. They've come from the girls in the Lancashire towns, they've come from Yorkshire, they've come from Wales, they've come from the Midlands. Women, all kinds, women who have to go out to work, as I've been out to work, but work in factories, in shops. They're thrilled.
Yes. Indeed, it's true to say that we've had quite a lot of correspondence in from women who say they just don't know how you do it. They don't know how you manage to run
a home. Well, if I stopped to think how I did it, I wouldn't know either. But I do it the way they do it. We just get on with a job in hand and somehow it all gets done.
But there's an awful lot of it, isn't there? I mean, do you really cook breakfast for your husband in the morning before you go?
Always, because we have a very small house and we wouldn't have room for a housekeeper to have her own quarters, which she'd need. So I do. But my husband did say to me at the beginning of the week, am I ever going to see you again? And I think I had to say, well, not this week. You know, except just for breakfast and a fleeting glimpse.
Or if he can pop down to the house, perhaps. That's about
yes.
How do you feel deep down about, I mean, all politicians, especially when they rise to eminence, get personal attacks upon them, don't they? I mean,
yes.
It's to be expected. Now, how do you feel about that? Because it must be extremely painful at times,
I imagine. It is very painful, and you do have to build up a bit of an armour and never be misled by the armour. You have to have an armour on top because you're a bit soft and sensitive underneath, and sometimes the armour is pierced. But it's one of the things which you have to learn to accept. In the end, what is important is that your decisions are such that you can live with yourself at the end of the day. Some of them are tough, but in the end, you've got to be able to convince yourself, well, I did it because I had to do it, and all things considered, it was the right thing to do. Mm. But they do hurt.
Yeah.
They do hurt.
Yeah. But not, you don't think they hurt you any more because you're a woman than they would if you were a man, for instance. I mean, your womanly
emotion. I don't think
so.
I tell you when they really hurt, sometimes when I was at education, and it was quite clear that a number of the commentators disapproved of my policies because they were fundamentally of a different view. And I had a lot of attacks then made upon me. And I know some of my family then said, oh, is it worth it, Mummy? And I said, now, look, that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to get rid of me by these attacks, and they're jolly well not going to succeed.
But indeed, when you were at education, they very nearly did succeed, didn't they? There was a time when you've admitted that you came very close to a breakdown, in fact.
No, never close to a breakdown. Close to wondering whether it was worthwhile.
Yeah.
But never, in fact, did I actually... never was I close to resignation.
No.
Never.
Do you... your wardrobe, we have to talk about your wardrobe, don't we?
It's very small. It's one cupboard.
Since your election, several yes. newspapers have published suggestions of new wardrobes or what you ought to wear or whatever. How do you react to that sort of
well,
thing?
Well, I thought some of them were absolutely lovely, but I didn't think they were the sort of clothes that I could wear for my kind of life. You see, I have to wear really tailored things and fairly good plain colours because you've got to consider what you're going to look like on a platform. Now, if you have, at a distance with people at the back of the hall, if you have things very soft and very highly patterned, then you don't get a very clear outline. So I think on the whole, tailored things are best. I looked at some of the things they said I should wear. They were very expensive, much more than I would pay, and they wouldn't have lasted. Mine have to last. And bearing in mind that this morning I left home at 8:30, I've got to change later tonight. They've also got to be the sort you can sit around in, clamber in and out of cars in all day, and still look reasonably fresh at the end of it.
Yes. Perhaps a little later on in the programme we can get into more specific things about that you will be all doing with the party and so on.
Yes.
One thing I wanted to ask you, because you've been on the programme several times now, and I've never yet seen you wearing a hat. And yet every time we see cartoons, you're always wearing a hat in the cartoon. Where do they get this hat business
from? I know. Well, if ever I've worn one, it's been a special occasion. Therefore, it's been rather a special hat. And one looked rather like a bullseye. I think I wore it about three times. And then it went to one of these auctions and hat stalls. And it's been the absolute boon to the cartoonists ever since. But I haven't even got it. I wish I'd kept it. And the other thing is, I'm always called the Lady of the Twin Sets. You know, I haven't owned a twin set for 25 years. I simply must buy one sometime.
It's strange how people get these ideas fixed
isn't
in their
it?
Head, isn't it?
Yes.
Still, as long as it's a dream to the cartoonist that day, you should worry.
Well, it helps them.
Margaret, I've got quite a lot of reaction while you've been on from listeners. I just wonder if I could fire some of them
at you. Yes,
let's
listen to what they have to say.
Mrs. Rengeli from Angmering on Sea says, is there any way that Mrs. Thatcher can stop the Labour government from going through with a referendum on the common market? She says, I really don't think that the general public know enough about this issue to be able to vote on it themselves. That's Mrs. Rengeli of Angmering.
I think Mrs. Rengeli has taken a point which has often been put to me. People say, look, we send you to Parliament to decide on these major things, and we really shall not have enough information on which to decide. But the Labour government, I think, is committed to this, and there's no way of stopping a bill unless some of their own people would vote against it. In fact, they've got an absolute majority over all other parties in the House of Commons, and the only thing would be for some of them to vote against their own party and vote with us. We're pledged to contest the second reading of the bill, and we shall do so. It's enormous constitutional implications. They haven't been worked out. There are all sorts of other things. How are you going to count the votes? You're going to count them on a national basis? How are you going to deal with expenses, etc.? So I think that we really have a point there to consider.
Yes, I mean, would you see the referendum campaign, if you like, as being perhaps the first big test of your leadership?
It's going to be a very curious campaign because it's not going to cut across party lines. It is going to cut across party lines. It's not going along party lines. It's going to cut across them. No, I don't think that is so much as a test of one's leadership. The government has got itself on this hook. I don't think it should have got itself on it. I really don't like the idea of a referendum to decide whether Britain should dishonour a treaty.
Yes, right. That's Mrs. Rengeli of Angmering. I got one from Mr. Brindley of Rugeley in Staffordshire. It says on the question of self-employed people.
He says, my goodness, they're very angry at the moment.
Yeah,
I'm
self-employed.
Yes. you know all about it then, yes.
Mr. Brindley says there are 2 million self-employed people in this country who are very angry at the present record rates and taxes. They don't wish to go on strike, even if they could, because of tremendous losses. And then he says, if the miners, for instance, can go on strike and get what they want, what can the self-employed do?
Well, they are now making their protests known, and thank goodness, because I think they have had a raw deal. They've had to take these enormous increases in national insurance contributions. Of course, that's not allowed for tax. Comes out of income which you've got left after tax. They really have had to take the big increases in rates, and then if they do run their own little shop or business, they've had to bear all the increases in cost of keeping stock without having, as yet, any allowance for tax. So they've had to take it on three fronts. Now, they are at last protesting, and I can see why they are. I think it's one of the tragedies of politics in the last 2 or 3 years that those who have made most protest and most noise and most fuss have got what they wanted. And the ordinary quiet chap who's carried on with doing a quiet job well hasn't. And I'm glad they're making their views known, because I think it does and will work in politics, and I think we ought to give more attention to the needs of the self-employed and not pile on tax after tax after tax and expect them just to take it.
How far, though, do you think that the silent majority, the silent people in the middle, let's put it, ought to go? Because we've got cases now, haven't we, where, I mean, people are just not sending their rates in and things like this, you know?
I have never and will never advocate people to go against the law. The law is the bulwark of a free society. But they must use all other means. You know, an avalanche of letters to a Member of Parliament is a very good thing. Having the meetings and protest rallies is another way of bringing your case to the people.
You see, we've got another one. You were talking about small shopkeepers just now, and you should know about.
I do indeed. This is where I was brought up.
As a grocer's daughter. Mrs. Roth of Camberley in Surrey is mainly on the same thing as Mr. Brindley was. She says, what does Mrs. Thatcher suggest to help the self-employed? We have a small business, and we just don't want to put prices up. That must be very difficult for these people.
Well, one of the things that could happen would be that the extra contributions they're going to have to pay on their weekly stamp could be allowed for tax. Now, that would help enormously. Now, secondly, it would have helped if we got more tax relief in this last budget for those who are self-employed, but we weren't successful. We hope it'll come in the next budget. Now, thirdly, we've got to have a look at the whole rating system. Local expenditure is going up and up and up, and it's gone up beyond people's capacity to pay. And this is what led me to say the other day, look, if the people can't afford it, then the local authorities and government can't make this extra expenditure. They must take into account the total burden on the taxpayer's pocket and the ratepayer's pocket. Poor chap, he's got two pockets. Out of one he pays taxes, out of another he pays rates, and he's not being left with enough to keep himself at the end of the day.
I just remind our listeners that our studio guest today is the Right Honourable Margaret Thatcher, and she's answering some of the questions that you have sent in, and you've got in touch with us since she's been on the air, indeed, for that matter. One such person is Mrs. Thorpe from Worcester.
Mrs. Thorpe.
As regards... Mrs. Thorpe, yes. As regards local planning, would it be possible to abolish planning permission for internal alterations and improvements to private houses? That's the one thing. And she says, as regards to government spending, why, when electricity and gas are both nationalised industries, why are they spending enormous amounts of money on advertising in competition with each other?
Well, now, let's have a look at the planning one first. She's obviously got a specific case in mind, and I'm not aware of the internal alterations point that she's making. I have trouble in a different way, because you can make a certain number of alterations to your house without getting planning permission. For example, you can build on an amount which is about equal to the size of a garage, but that, in fact, can create great trouble, say, for next door, the person who lives next door, whose light might be badly restricted. So the kind of trouble I have really is of two kinds. One, like people like Mrs. Thorpe saying we have to ask permission for too much, and I agree there's an argument for that. And the other's saying, look, my interests can in fact be harmed because the chap next door can do this without getting permission. There has to be a balance. You can't go to a bureaucrat for every decision. You just can't.
Right. What
and on the gas
the
and electricity,
yes,
I can see that she is a bit alarmed about this. In fact, it's a very tiny part of the total gas and electricity budget. Very, very small indeed. And what's really worrying us is the cost of keeping these industries going, which are not covered by charges, but then query whether the industry, having no competitors, could in fact be a jolly sight more efficient than they seem to be at the moment. And that, I think, is the angle we should pursue.
Right. I've got one here, Margaret, from Mrs. Schneider of Ringwood, who's been in touch with us while you've actually been on the air. She says, in view of the ever-rising cost in education, does Mrs. Thatcher think there's a case for studying the possibilities of changing some of our basic ideas about education? And would she consider the following points? There are three of them.
Mm-hmm.
A change in school hours, i.e. 8 until 1, thus saving on heating and school meal facilities. In the afternoons, the infant school buildings could be used for afternoon sessions of nursery school education, and senior school pupils could be encouraged to do community service or private study. That's one rather long question. B, school crossing control could be undertaken by senior school students. And C, all students could be encouraged to take responsibility from an early age and thus hopefully become more responsible adults. That's Mrs. Schneider of Ringwood and Hampshire, wanting a lot for her money, I may say.
Well, she's got a lot of interesting ideas, hasn't she?
Yeah.
I remember on a visit to Russia and some of the East European countries, they operate with their educational premises, both schools and universities, a double shift system. They have one lot going in the morning, about 8 to 1, and the other lot from about 1:30 to 5:30. Two different lots of teachers, obviously they couldn't possibly do it. But I don't think we'd like it here. It is one possible way of doing it, and I remember in wartime when we had a school evacuated on us, we went to school in the morning and they used the same premises in the afternoon. But I think it would be a too big a change at the moment for us to contemplate here. We are trying to see that you get maximum use of school premises. both in the evenings and in the vacations, provided your caretaking staff can cope. You've got to consider the cleaners and the caretakers and getting the premises right again. So, broadly, I would agree with Mrs. Snyder, we must look to see that the money the nation spends on building schools and equipment is properly used. But I don't think we could go over to a double shift system. Now, she asked something else. Oh, about school crossing patrols.
That's right.
It's a very big responsibility, you know, to put on senior pupils the whole responsibility for seeing smaller children across a busy road. It might be all right if there's a pedestrian crossing there, but so often there are not.
Quite. And her third point, which is an interesting one, I think, all students should be encouraged to take responsibility from an early age and thus hopefully would become more responsible adults.
I think this is very important. Of course, this is one of the reasons why schools have had prefects and school monitors for years. They are given responsibility, and of course you have to watch out to see that they use it and use it well. Because the danger at that age is that they tend to lead by authority, and one knows full well that there's only one way to lead, and that's by persuasion. But they've got to learn. Well, I agree, I'm all for giving people responsibility and seeing, of course, that they use it properly.
Right.
She's quite right.
Right. Mr. Charles White from Broadstairs.
Mr. White.
Also been in touch with us, Charles White from Broadstairs. This is an interesting one for you. What plans has Mr. Thatcher got to give tax relief to people who educate their children privately? He says, after all, if all privately educated children were thrust onto the state system, would it not collapse?
Well, it would certainly lead to a lot more expenditure. And he's quite right that people who educate their children privately take a burden off the state because they're paying twice over. They're paying their taxes for children to be educated, and then they're paying for their own children to be educated out of their own pockets. I don't see much possibility of tax relief for it at the moment. I think the only relief is the kind which you can make by having insurance policies, and you get relief on the premiums. And in fact, you've got to provide that almost from the time the child is born. There will be a problem with fees going up and up and up. And some people just may not be able to afford it. Now, I think the way to tackle that is not so much by tax relief, but by having more of the direct grant schools, you know, like Manchester Grammar School is a famous one, in which you've got some free places, some full fee paying, and some where you pay on a sliding scale according to what the parent can afford. They're a very good institution.
When you say pay according to what the parent can afford, is this, one hates to say the two emotive words, but is this a sort of means test?
Well, yes, it is, but so is income tax, isn't it?
Hmm.
So is income tax.
I don't object. I've never seen anything wrong with it.
There are schools, you know, you have to get in again on the basis of ability. And obviously, you ought not to be limited because you can't afford it.
Right. Now, our guest today, the Right Honourable Margaret Thatcher, who's leader of the opposition. The reason I'm smiling is because this lady here from Orpington, Mrs. Taylor, has taken me to task, Margaret, and she says, Jimmy Young should not be allowed to call someone who could be the future Prime Minister by her Christian name, and I should show you more respect.
Well, perhaps she doesn't know that we've known one another quite a long time, and I think friends are permitted to do that.
Well, I sincerely hope so, anyway.
I don't think there's anything unrespectful in my Christian name.
No, I wouldn't have thought so. Mr. Sweeney of Streatham has been in touch. He said, this is quite nice, actually. What we really need more than anything else is sincerity and truth. We've got to get back to being able to believe the people who govern us. And I think that Margaret Thatcher is one of these people who might be able to offer us this. However, let's wait and see, says Mr. Sweeney of Streatham.
Well, that's very kind of Mr. Sweeney, and I just hope he'll always be right. The day I don't show those, I shan't be fit to lead the Conservative Party.
Can I come back to the referendum? Two people who've been in touch with us are Mrs. Julia Hunt of West Woking and Mr. Frith of Highcliffe-on-Sea. Mrs. Hunt, first of all. Julia Hunt. She says, about the point of MPs, that MPs are elected to answer to and for the community, I think far too much is left to MPs, not nearly enough is left to the people. I would like to see many more referendums in this country. They have been successful in Switzerland. That's Mrs. Hunt.
Mrs. Hunt's right. They have been very successful in Switzerland, but they're geared up for them there. It is part of their constitution. But on the whole, some of the things which they have to answer by referendum are much clearer questions than the one we shall have to cope with on the common market. I well remember that they'd put the sort of question, do you think the school leaving age should go up to 16? Now, that's a fairly clear-cut question. do you think that school should open at a certain time in the morning? And you'll find that the rules are quite different from one canton to another in Switzerland, because these things have been decided by referendum. But they're clear-cut questions. You could in this country have a clear-cut question. Do you think capital punishment should be restored? People would understand that and have very definite views upon it. But about a common market treaty and the negotiations, that's a very, very different thing.
Well, and a complicated thing. And indeed, we've got a question about that, which has just come in. Mr. Frith of Highcliffe-on-Sea. He says, what plans does Mrs. Thatcher have to explain the common market to the people of Britain? It is terribly important. And most people just don't seem to have a clue what it's all about.
Well, there are meetings being held up and down the country under the European movement to try to explain it. And they're already in process, those meetings. And I hope that people will flock to attend them.
Could I come back to, leave the listener's question just for a second and come back to some of our own? The talk of a coalition which was going around quite strongly at one time, what was your reaction to that?
Well, I think you can only get a coalition if you're all aiming for exactly the same things. And that does mean that the present government would have to drop a lot of its extremist policies. I would say extremist, its plans to nationalise, concerns whether they'd be making a loss or whether they may be making a profit. Otherwise, none of us could possibly join in with a government which had that aim. I don't know whether one will come, and it's very difficult to foretell. It just depends what their own extreme left wing will do. You see, if they take the right economic policies for the people of this country and really try to stem inflation, we will support them. We don't take the quick party political line. Now, for example, you remember I was coming here as Minister of Education, and I had to put up the price of school meals, and I had to put up the price because the costs had gone up. Now, when I had a Labour opposition, they caused and created no end of trouble about it. Now, when they're in government, reality faces them too. They had to do exactly the same thing. They announced it quietly before Christmas in a written answer to a written question. Now, we didn't create a fuss because we knew that had to be done. So when they do things which have to be done for good economic reasons, we in fact don't take a party political line, we do support them. They're a jolly sight luckier with having a responsible opposition than we are when we're in government.
When you think the headlines in the last week or so have been getting better, it's true to say. Nonetheless, prior to that, when you pick up the paper or switch on the telly or whatever, and it was all gloom and doom and so on and so on. I mean, in your opinion, what's the root cause of the problem with Britain? What basically is wrong with Britain?
We won't face inflation. We won't face inflation, and we won't face the fact that ultimately you've got to pay your way. We're borrowing more money now per year to keep going than we've ever borrowed in the history of Britain. And that's the only reason why we're keeping up our standard of living. Well, of course, if your bank manager will let you have loan upon loan upon loan to keep up your standards, a lot of people will go on. But the time comes when you've got to repay, and that's going to be the difficulty.
So, which begs the next question, which is that supposing you were transformed into number 10 tomorrow, at a stroke, so to speak, what would you do?
Ultimately, over a considerable period, you've got to plan to live within your means. You must, above all, tackle inflation quite sternly, I think, because we're now running at about the rate of 20% per year. Well, you know, if you went out to work at the age of 18 and had quite a big salary of, say, £1,800 a year, and inflation, £1,800 a year, and inflation went on at the present rate year after year after year, then by the time you were 30, you'd have to have a salary of £16,000 a year merely to buy the same things as you could have bought with £1,800 a year at 18. Now, that's ridiculous. No one would be any better off. We might just as well tackle it.
Yeah, I believe someone once calculated that a semi in Bromley would cost £250,000.
Yes. Yeah, but it's silly, isn't it? Yeah. And people, when you put it in those terms, realise it can't go on.
So, what would you physically do about it? I mean, you would have to take unpleasant measures, presumably.
Well, yes, you can't, in fact, do it without taking unpleasant measures. First, you can't keep ordinary public expenditure going up, because you're spending really more of the people's income than they're willing to let you spend, and so you're having to borrow to do it. You've got to curb your public expenditure, what you've got coming in. Now, I do think that Healy is, the present Chancellor of the Exchequer, is doing the right thing on the supply of money. He's keeping it within production. But he's got to do other things as well, and that is act on public expenditure and slowly reduce our borrowings. You can't do it suddenly. It's got to be done gradually over a period of about 5 years.
Hmm. We've got a rather succinct question from a Mrs. Day of Penarth in Glamorgan.
Let's hope we give a succinct answer. I don't think the Prime Minister could. He's very woolly and waffly in replying.
Well, this is fairly straightforward. Mrs. Day says, why will people vote for Margaret Thatcher at the next election?
Well, I hope because they like the policies she will pursue and they believe in the person who puts them across.
But you wouldn't sort of expand very much on those policies at the moment, presumably.
Well, I believe the policies are in general understood. Promotion on merit. If people save, they must have the benefits of their savings. If they work harder, they must have more rewards. And I think, above all, we must not go on transferring more and more power to the hands of the state. And that's what's happening. More and more the state's doing everything, and that's leaving too little power in the hands of the people. It's going to become a state for bureaucrats. That's not Britain.
Oh, incidentally, before I do ask you the next listener's question, Margaret, perhaps I could just say our switchboard is going a little bit raving mad downstairs, so if listeners could perhaps lay off just a little bit for the next 10 or 15 minutes or so, that would help our telephone.
It's rather nice. So many people are interested. They're phoning in. I think that's a great compliment. Thank you very much. I'm sorry it gives your switchboard trouble, but there you are.
I agree with you, madam, if I may say so. Yes, can I ask you about Mr. Melvin Dunn's been in touch with us from Hitchin.
Yes.
This is not a question for you, actually. It's a rather nice little tribute, if I may say so, with a sting in the tail.
As
a long-term, middle-class Scottish socialist, I would like to pay tribute to Margaret Thatcher for bringing more fresh air into politics in the past 10 days than we've had in the past 10 years. I wish her all the luck in the world, but I'm afraid I shall still vote for Harold Wilson.
Oh, dear. Well, Mr. Dunn, if you're going to carry on voting that way, let me tell you something. That party needs a breath of fresh air, too.
It's a shame he added those last 6 words. We've been going quite nicely till then. Mrs. Downs of Salisbury, what is Mrs. Thatcher going to do about housing? Does she have any plans for a means test for council tenants so that council houses aren't full of middle-aged people earning a good wage while young marrieds can't get anywhere to live? That's Mrs. Downs of Salisbury.
Yes, Mrs. Downs, it's very difficult. And what we had planned was to say that people who can afford to pay full rents should, of course, pay full rents. They have no right to come on the rest of the general body of taxpayers. And we felt that those who had to pay full rents would often prefer to buy their own houses. I think it's quite wrong that just because a person can't get a house, you say to them, all right, there's a council flat or house, you must rent it. Why shouldn't you say to them, all right, you're in difficulty, we'll supply you with a house. Now, you can either rent it, or you can buy it, or you can, say, take an option to buy it. You might not be ready to buy it yet, but if you pay just a little bit each week and decide to buy it in, say, 5 years' time, that little bit each week that's been saved up would go to a deposit, and then you can buy it, or you can have it returned. Now, that way, I think we'd get a lot of people responding. And I think that people who had to pay the full rent for their council houses, if they could afford it, would then say, we'd rather buy.
Talking about renting, we've got a question here from a Mrs. S, who didn't give us her full name. I don't know why, but anyway, that doesn't matter. She said her sole income comes from rents from a house in Kensington, which is divided into bed sitting rooms, each of which has its own bathroom. So she's got bed sits with bathrooms. Her rents are now fixed by law, and yet she says the rates which she herself pays have gone up £400 in the last 2 years, and that now there is a possibility of another really massive increase. And, she would rather like to know.
And she can't cope.
That's right.
Well, now, look, it's only the rents that are fixed by law, and they can be fixed exclusive of rates. So she really ought to be charging her tenant the amount of rent that is fixed by law and whatever the rates are according to that flat. She's not meant to bear the rates, the increases in rates herself. It's only the rent that can be fixed. So I think it would perhaps be better. She had a look at the agreement with her tenants, consulted the rent officer, and then claimed the increase in rates.
Hmm. Mrs. Cooper of Bushy Heath, this is a subject which we talked about on the programme quite recently, actually. What plans does Mrs. Thatcher have for improving the lot of widows?
Oh, they have had a marvellous campaign.
That's Mrs. Cooper.
They very much want tax relief, and I must confess I'm one of the people who would like them, more tax relief, to have it. But I'm very well aware that my government did not provide it, and that makes me go slow on promises, because they can say, well, you were in government, you didn't provide it. But I really think we've got to consider the lot of the widow who all of a sudden has to face outgoings which were really more geared to her husband's income than to her own. She can't get out of them. She's probably running a family house. All the electricity bills, the rate bills go on. And I do think that we must consider giving her a rather larger tax relief than she's had hitherto. You see, it's no earthly good saying we can sell the house and go to a smaller one. You often can't do that until the market's right for selling that kind of house. Mm. And then it's jolly expensive moving. Your carpets and your curtains never fit. And I think we must consider it. I can't say I will promise to do it, because I know that we didn't do it when we were in power. But I think we've all seriously got to consider this.
Irene Livingston with a Lancing telephone number. She's on the subject of rates.
Yes.
I feel, she says, that when there are so many people earning a wage, everybody should contribute towards the rates, not just the householder. She said everybody has the use of the amenities provided by the rates, e.g. libraries and so on. So I think everybody should pay. What is Mrs. Thatcher's opinion? That's Irene Livingston.
Yes, well, I agree with her. And this is one of the reasons which led me to say that the rating system won't last, because there are far more taxpayers than there are ratepayers. And in fact, I think the ratepayer faces an unfairly large share of the burden. And therefore, I think, in the end, we shall have to abandon rates and spread the burden more fairly among taxpayers. She's quite right. It'll take 5 or 6 years to do. It was part of our policy, but I don't think the present government's following it.
Mrs. Knight from Hampshire. These are all things, as I say, which have come in while you've been
Knight,
on.
Yes.
Mrs. Knight. About education. Would Mrs. Thatcher be in favour of a pilot scheme for introducing the voucher system for funding education, which she says, I believe, is a system used in America?
Yes, there is a system in California, and it's a very good one, because it helps parents to choose between the sort of teaching they want as well. You know, they would say, look, my child wants what is called a progressive, in inverted commas, education, and another one wants a traditional education, and they can use their vouchers accordingly. Now, I didn't think it would be possible for us to get a local authority or local council to agree to a voucher scheme, but I understand that at present, Kent would be prepared to agree to a pilot scheme. So it would be possible.
That's very interesting. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that. Mrs. Whiting of Ewell says she's worked all her life and she's paid tax on her earnings, and now she's got to pay tax on her savings. She says, exactly what do the Inland Revenue mean by unearned income?
Oh, dear, they mean savings income, and she's quite right. It's not unearned. It's often very, very hard earned and put to savings. And the tax on savings income is far too high. Now, look, politician after politician is saying we've got to invest more in Britain. Now, it's not fair to say you must invest your money, but if you do, then the interest or dividend you get from it are going to be specially highly taxed. If you want people to invest, you must give them incentives to invest and reduce the tax upon the dividends and interest they get from it. It's a ridiculous policy they're pursuing at the moment.
Mrs. Holder of Worcester Park.
I must say, we get through more here than we do on any questions. Yes, go on. Mrs. Holder, yes?
Of Worcester Park. Can't Mrs. Thatcher do anything for the doctors and nurses in this country? Nothing seems to be getting done for them, and I think they deserve better treatment from the government, if anybody does.
Well, I think they're very, very dissatisfied indeed, and we're losing a lot of our very well-trained people to overseas. The future of the National Health Service, I think, is one of the worrying things, because I can't foresee a time when we're going to get in enough money out of taxation to run it as we would like to run it. And that's one of the things to which we must give very considerable attention in the future weeks and months.
Could I ask you, price rises? Now, Timothy Raisin apparently said yesterday that price rises were inevitable, and he meant that you would aim to remove subsidies. What are your views generally on subsidies?
The subsidies are only holding down a tiny little amount each week, and they're costing the general taxpayer more and more. I think it's far better to help those people who need help, say if you've got some of your retirement pensioners who need more help, with increased pensions, than it is to give general subsidies to everyone. I think that's really a rather ridiculous scheme. Rab Butler had to get rid of food subsidies over a period, a long time ago. But what he did was say, look, children will need help, old people will need help, we'll put up the pensions to take into account what we're going to knock off subsidies. But it's cheaper on the taxpayer to do it that way. And we have to consider the general body of taxpayers too.
It does seem at the moment, does it not, that people who get the subsidy who don't really need the subsidy.
That's the trouble. Yeah. That's the trouble. You pay towards the subsidy out of one pocket and you get it back by another. But in between, you've got also to pay for a large bureaucracy to run the subsidies.
We've just what time, I should think, for one final... You must be worn out, you know.
No, I'm not worn out. I can't be. There's the greater part of the day to come, and later in the afternoon we have our first new shadow cabinet, so yeah. I must be bright and brisk and crisp for that.
So this is just a sort of run-in for the big moment.
Well, I think it'll be a little bit different.
Mrs. Bentinck, although I would have thought this is Mr. Bentinck, but anyway, from St. Merrin in Cornwall, says, as an out-of-work stockbroker, I'm obviously interested in the financial state of the country, and I would like to ask Mrs. Thatcher if there's any logic in borrowing at high rates of interest for our survival and then loaning sums of money to Russia at low rates of interest.
No, this came up in the House yesterday. He's quite right. We do borrow from the oil people at about 14-15% it costs us each year. And then the news came with Mr. Wilson yesterday that he was going to lend up to £1,000 million to Russia on credit so that people could export goods to them. He hasn't said precisely what is the rate of interest. It's thought it's about 7-7.5%. So we're borrowing money at 15%, 14-15%, to lend it out to Russia at 7-7.5%. And I was bound to say I thought that he'd brought back a very good deal for Russia.
In fact, you did say, didn't you?
I did say that. He didn't like it. And this is why I say he made a very, very long reply. But I think it was a proper summary.
Mrs. Fisher of Richmond says, Mrs. Thatcher became an MP when her children were about 4 years old. However, most educationists and paediatricians consider that a mother's place is in the home when children are that age. And does she really think that a mother ought to go out to work?
Well, it was, in fact, 6 years old, Mrs. Fisher, and I know the importance of those early years. And I could not have done it unless we'd lived in London and my job had been in London, and I'm the first to recognise that. But you know, Mrs. Fisher, there are many women who are on their own with children. They're widows or they're deserted. They don't make any the less good mothers because of that. I think it's not only the amount of time you spend with your children, but what you do in that time. You must find time to talk to them, whether you're a working wife or whether you're a mother at home. And there are, you know, some mothers at home who don't spend very much more time actually talking to their children than some of us who go out to work. Whether you go out to work or whether you're at home, it's very important in those early years to spend time talking to the children, genuinely interested in them, and it can happen either way.
Could I leave listeners' questions just for a second and ask you a few things, perhaps about your party?
Yes.
I mean, it has been said in the press quite often that the Conservative Party is in danger of becoming a party of the southeast, so to speak. How strong is your knowledge of the North and the Midlands, and what are you intending to do to reverse that?
Well, of course, I was born in the Midlands, and I agree. It's a great criticism that we have already lost quite a number of our northern seats, and we must get them back. We're a party that believes in trade and industry. Britain survives on her trade and industry, whether it's the retail trade or Britain as the workshop of the world. And we must go right back working in those seats, pointing out the virtues to Britain of companies privately owned, not all in state hands, pointing out the virtues of hard work, pointing out that if you want the kind of Britain that we have known and the kind of things that's made Britain famous, you know, individual initiative, operating on your own without having to wait for instructions, then the kind of society that we, the Conservatives, want is the right one for Britain, and we must just get around, because we're in danger of being judged by labels at the moment, and I want us to be judged by people and by policies.
But would you agree that the Conservative Party has become a party of the south of England, so to speak?
Well, mercifully we have still some seats in Scotland and in the northwest and in the northeast and in the Midlands. We've enough left to build upon for the future.
Hmm. I always hate the word class, I must say.
I loathe it.
Yeah, but I have to ask you a question about class just the same. Because the papers continually refer to you as middle class, you see. Now, I mean, would you see yourself as leading a middle class revival, so to speak?
No, the things I stand for are things which appeal to people from whatever their walk of life or background. I think that when I first came into politics as a member of parliament about 1959, I thought everyone, if you have to have a class, was about middle class, and I still believe they are. But in fact, I think it's what you stand for and your attitude to politics which is what counts. And for heaven's sake, let's get rid of these silly, stupid labels. Other countries have, we must.
You're talking about your attitude to politics. Could I ask you this? I mean, you are, to an extent, I suppose, an unknown quantity.
You're doing your best to make me known. Thank you very much.
No, but I mean, yes. people know your views on education and so on and things like that. But in lots of areas, they don't know your views. I mean, what specific things, politically speaking, do you feel particularly strongly about, passionately about, if you like?
Well, I just feel passionately that if you've got what it takes, you should be allowed to enjoy some of the benefits from your own hard work, but you should also pass on some of those benefits to people who are disabled or, for one reason or another, can't help themselves. I really am very interested in those who can make Britain great by their own efforts and in those who have enough public conscience and sense of duty to say there are some, particularly the disabled, and some of the elderly, who can't fend, or most of the elderly, who can't fend for themselves. As we prosper ourselves, we prosper others. But our duty doesn't finish at the end of the day with our job. We've also got a duty to the town in which we live, to the sort of community in which we live. But we're in danger of losing that. As things become all state-owned, they are professionally managed. No longer the small local businesses where the chaps who ran them knew the chaps who worked in them, knew the local council, knew what needed doing in the town, took an interest in the town because they were brought up there, loved it because generations had. For heaven's sake, let's look after some of these small businesses and some of these people who can build new ones so that we have a really human society and not just an economic system.
Perhaps I could ask you just a final couple before we let you go. The decentralisation and regional government moves and so on, what are your feelings about that?
I know people feel very strongly that far too many decisions are taken in Whitehall. They don't like size, and neither do I. This is one of the reasons why I limited the numbers of comprehensive schools. We do want the kind of society in which you know and can see and can face the chap who makes the decision. That means not having all the power in the hands of the state, but having it to local communities.
Relaxing. I mean, you obviously work extremely hard, and we used to see pictures of Ted Heath with his yacht and so on. I mean, what do you do to relax?
Yes, well, Mr. Heath hadn't a house to run. I have a house to run and meals to do, etc., and all the other things to do. And somehow I manage to cope with that. When I really have time to relax, I would love to listen to music, to go to theatre, but I like also to read. And above all, as a family, we just like to talk among ourselves. You know, not enough is done about that. And also to have friends in and talk with them. So they're very simple pleasures. And for choice of a holiday, I would just, if I could, take the car and go among the English, the Scottish, the Welsh countryside.
Hmm. Margaret, thank you very much for coming in again and talking to me.
Thank you very much. I've thoroughly enjoyed it, as always. And good luck to all your listeners.
Thank you, and I hope to see you again.
Thank you.
I have an apology to make, you know. I've been a male chauvinistic pig, haven't I? Mrs. Bentinck phoned in from St. Merrin in Cornwall, you see, says, as an out-of-work stockbroker, and I thought our lady's upstairs. It's true to say, Mrs. Bentinck, I thought our lady's upstairs had already mistyped it, you see. So I said, I expect that's Mr. Bentinck. And we've had an irate Mrs. Bentinck on the phone saying, why shouldn't I be a lady stockbroker? And quite right, madam, there is no reason at all why you shouldn't be a lady stockbroker.